Gaza has so far killed more than 70,100 civilians, leaving nearly 171,000 others injured. Our Gaza correspondent, Muti Abu Musabbeh, joined us earlier with more details on the regime's truce violations.
Let me start with what's happening right now in the eastern side of At-Tufah, Nabahout. As you know, several Palestinian families are reportedly trapped right now in the houses that were targeted by the Israeli occupation forces by the extensive artillery strikes, in addition to the, as you know, to the Israeli quadcopter drones, which dropped several incendiary bombs targeting those houses, as you know, erupting several places and fires in those areas. Meanwhile, the Palestinian civil defense system in Gaza City has reported and stated that the teams are unable to reach and approach those areas as a result of the extensive attacks of the Israeli occupation forces. The situation is very perilous right now in those areas as a result of the constant attacks of the Israeli occupation forces. So this reveals how the Israeli regime is still escalating and is stepping up, as you know, its attacks against those areas. And this comes against the backdrop of the systematic policy of the Israeli regime in terms of, as you know, continuing those flagrant violations of the ceasefire agreement on the ground. We are talking about more attacks are still carried out regularly against various parts of Gaza Strip, and we are talking about several focal points of those frequent attacks that are still claiming more lives of the Palestinian people and leaving more Palestinian casualties as well, because a short while ago another Palestinian civilian was confirmed wounded.
The Hamas resistance movement has slammed Israel's restrictions on the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza, especially tents and prefabricated homes. Hamas spokesperson Hazem Qasem stressed that existing shelters and tents are uninhabitable and cannot withstand the harsh winter conditions. He said Israel continues to allow only limited quantities of trucks into Gaza that do not meet even the minimum of basic needs of its people amid the worsening humanitarian situation. Qasem added that most trucks entering Gaza are designated for the commercial sector and carry supplementary goods that are not essential for the Palestinian people. He said Gaza needs the entry of trucks that would carry essential relief materials and in large quantities to address the scale of the crisis faced by over 2 million people. He said the Gaza truce deal included entry of mobile homes in order to alleviate the suffering of civilians. Qasem called on mediators and other nations to take urgent and serious action to allow the entry of mobile homes before winter storms hit Gaza. Well, pro-Palestine demonstrators have taken to the streets in Mexico's capital city, calling on the government to cut ties with Israel. Protesters said keeping any kind of relationship with Israel only helps support the regime as it continues its crimes against the Palestinians in Gaza. From Mexico City, our correspondent Sarah Morales-Gallego has more.
People have marched in Mexico City to mark the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. Protesters have called on the Mexican government to cut all types of relations with Israel.
We know what is truly being sought right now is simply to serve the interests of capitalism and the powerful. That is why we are calling on the Mexican government to cut relations with Israel, stop investing and buying their weapons, and end Israel's training of our police and armed forces. This way, the government will stop supporting Israel.
The protesters also demanded their authorities lead international efforts to oppose the so-called peace plan proposed by U.S. President Donald Trump. They want the Mexican government to impose military and energy embargoes against Israel and to help enforce arrest warrants against Israeli officials over the genocide in Gaza.
It is very, very important that the government take stronger action to break relations with Israel.
A humanist country has nothing to do with a murderous entity. That must be made clear to society.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people is annually marked on November 29th. The occasion this year is marked as the occupation of the West Bank continues and the genocide in Gaza persists despite a ceasefire.
This is definitely a test by this neo-fascist advance. driven by the savage capitalism we are living through. They are carrying out these kinds of actions not only in Palestine but also, for example, in Latin America.
If the United States had stopped selling weapons to Israel, the genocide would have ended. Both Democrats and Republicans have been facilitating it. The Biden administration gave $22 billion in 12 months to Israel, and Trump has made that commercial and military relationship with Israel explicit. That's why we are going to the U.S. Embassy, because they, along with Israel, are the ones truly responsible.
Mexicans in solidarity with the Palestinian people continue to demand that the government of Claudia Sheinbaum sever all types of relations with Israel and call for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions targeting anyone who finances or benefits from the genocide.
The United Nations marks the annual International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people on November the 29th. This year's Day of Solidarity was marked by a diplomatic, political, and cultural program at the UN headquarters in Vienna, Austria, on Monday. Our correspondent Dieter Renesch reports.
The UN General Assembly officially established International Solidarity Day in 1977 to express its concern about the continuing plight of the Palestinian people.
Despite the ceasefire, it is still an ongoing genocide. So the special thing is we're trying to bring to the attention of the international community about the plight of the Palestinian people, not only the genocide in Gaza, but also the terror of the settlers in the West Bank.
Speakers stressed that the Palestinian people have not yet achieved their inalienable right as defined by the General Assembly, namely the right to self-determination and national independence, among other things.
The occupation has no moral limits, but during the past 2 years, the Palestinian people have shown their resistance, which made Israel a pariah state. This is what we celebrate on this day. The project for Palestinian nationhood will not come to an end because the Arab states support it.
Representatives and ambassadors from dozens of UN member states expressed their support for Palestine, while many criticized UN Security Council for its inaction to end the Gaza genocide. On November 17th, the Security Council adopted Resolution 2803, which endorsed U.S. President Donald Trump's so-called peace plan for Gaza.
The document contains several deeply problematic elements. Israel's obligations as an occupying power, including the renunciation of annexation of Palestinian lands and the withdrawal of its forces, are not enshrined. Resolution 2803, adopted by the UN Security Council, does not vest it with the necessary prerogatives to maintain peace and security.
The Day of Solidarity at UN concluded with a cultural program featuring the Palestinian choir, Shatat, screenings of Gaza documentaries and Palestinian cuisine.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people at UN headquarters in Vienna concludes a series of events and demonstrations over the past days and weeks. Cultural events, diplomatic meetings, and protests were well attended by representatives and people from around the world. However, diplomats from Western states remained largely absent from any shows of solidarity with the Palestinians. Dieter Reinisch from UN headquarters in Vienna.
Well, Pakistan's defense minister says Muslim countries may need to reassess their approach to the Gaza peace efforts, citing repeated ceasefire violations by Israeli forces. The remarks come as regional governments debate how to respond to the shifting situation. Ghanwa Mohideen reports.
Pakistan's defense minister Khwaja Asif has said that Muslim countries should revisit their diplomatic stance on Gaza, arguing that incessant Israeli ceasefire violations have undermined peace efforts. His comments come as several regional governments express frustrations over the failure of internationally backed agreements to halt military operations. Officials in Islamabad say any reassessment would aim to push for a more reliable framework that prevents future breaches. The idea of a collective Muslim response has been gaining traction in recent weeks, particularly as the Gaza humanitarian concerns deepen.
Daily ceasefire violations are occurring by the Israeli forces, and Muslim Ummah needs to be united and have one solution with one voice, but they are not raising their voices against the Israelis.
Countries across West Asia have been consulting one another on possible political steps, including coordinated pressure through regional bodies. Observers say the broader question is whether Muslim-majority states can unify around a position strong enough to influence future negotiations. Pakistan's call reflects a wider debate over the limits of current mediation efforts. They point out any new approach would require consensus among key regional actors and a clearer mechanism for enforcing commitments on all sides and a more sustainable political roadmap for Gaza.
What will Israel do? Will it continue to violate the ceasefire? This is an existential question for all the countries who have agreed to this U.S.-backed solution. How long will they allow Israel to kill innocent Palestinian children? No, they will reconsider.
The debate points to a wider re-evaluation underway throughout the Muslim world, suggesting that Gaza's future may hinge on a new coordinated regional strategy that could reshape the way the conflict is addressed. Khanwa Muhyiddin, Islamabad.
Palestinian fighters have carried out another resistance operation against Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank, injuring at least one of the regime's troops in a car-ramming attack. According to Palestinian sources, the attack occurred near Halhul, north of the city of Al-Khalil. A large number of occupation forces were deployed to the site of the attack after its executor fled the scene. Hamas hailed the attack as a natural and legitimate answer to Israeli forces' daily crimes across the occupied territories. The operation came after the military wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad said its fighters detonated a guided explosive device on the path of Israeli military vehicles in the town of Qabatia, hitting one of the enemy's vehicles. Al-Quds Brigades added that its fighters targeted an Israeli infantry force with several anti-personnel explosives and hand grenades. They also detonated a land mine targeting an Israeli military vehicle, causing confirmed casualties. The Israeli military confirmed that one of its troops has been killed in the occupied West Bank city of Tubas, claiming the soldier died in a driving incident. Our West Bank correspondent Naqat Ahmed joined us earlier with more details on the latest resistance operation that targeted Israeli forces near Al-Khalil.
Israeli forces announced that an Israeli female soldier had been rammed over by a Palestinian car, and then the Israeli forces fired live ammunition against the Palestinian driver, injuring him, and then he was successfully escaping the scene and going into the city of Al-Khalil. Of course, as the Israeli forces have gathered their troops and gathered their vehicles into the northern part of occupied Al-Khalil, immediately a large incursion have started towards the city of occupied Al-Khalil. Until now, four Palestinian hospitals have been raided into occupied Al-Khalil, Al-Ahli, Al-Mizan, Al-Muhtasib, and Alia, where all those are all hospitals, and they were all raided and searched on the Palestinian performer, and of course in a confirmation from the Israeli forces that the performer is in he's injured and he might seek medical care. Of course, on the ground in occupied Al-Khalil, things remain tensive as this is an ongoing event. But according to the Israeli forces, they have said that the family of the female soldier have been notified about the situation. And this means something, Kiarish. This means that the situation of this soldier is not light, and it can, we might be looking towards an extremely heavy injury towards that soldier.
Well, Iran's foreign minister says that the United States must regain Tehran's trust before returning to diplomacy with the Islamic Republic. Abbas Araghchi was speaking in a phone conversation with his Japanese counterpart, Motegi Toshimitsu. The two top diplomats were discussing the latest developments related to Iran's peaceful nuclear program and the positions taken by the United States and the European Troika. Araghchi expressed hope that Tehran and Tokyo would continue close and effective cooperation, given their history of constructive ties. The Japanese foreign minister, for his part, reiterated his country's commitment to playing a constructive role in promoting peace and stability in West Asia. He said Tokyo supports political initiatives for the resolution of regional and international issues. Well, now moving over to the Venezuelan president, who has once again slammed Washington's aggressive stance against Caracas as tensions between the Latin American country and the United States continue to rise. Addressing thousands of his supporters, Nicolas Maduro said, Venezuela wants peace, but peace with sovereignty, equality, freedom. He added that his people do not want, quote, a slave's peace, nor the peace of colonies. Maduro also touched on the United States naval buildup in the Caribbean, saying his country has endured 22 weeks of aggression that he described as psychological terrorism. He said during those weeks, the U.S. has been testing the people of Venezuela, but they have demonstrated their love for the homeland. Maduro's speech came as Washington keeps mounting pressure on Caracas. American forces have so far launched over 20 strikes on boats in the Caribbean and Pacific, killing over 80 people, claiming they were drug traffickers. Human rights groups have called the attacks illegal extrajudicial killings and potential violations of international law. Well, thank you very much for Basara's headlines. More updates, as always, please stay tuned to World News. Goodbye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Music is an inseparable part of our lives, and today I'm going to show you a very special musical instrument that is said to be invented by Iranians many, many years ago. The santur, also referred to as the hammered dulcimer, is a stringed musical instrument that is played by striking the strings stretched on a trapezoidal box with two wooden mallets. The musical instrument is believed to have originated in Iran and later introduced to Southeast Asia and Central Europe. And considering the particular way the santur is played, music historians believe that it would be logical to assume that it provided much of the inspiration for inventing the piano. In Iran, the santur has plenty of fans. Young people who are interested in traditional Persian music usually take lessons to learn how to play the santur. However, it takes many years of painstaking practice to master the art. Thorough academic knowledge about traditional Persian music and its melodic movements is important, but agility is the key. You have to be quick in striking the steel and brass strings that pass over the bridges, which provide the high and low notes, respectively. Master Siamak Oghoi is one of the most prominent santur players in Iran, who has been playing the instrument since childhood and has learned the art with some of the greatest masters of our time. He reintroduced the Iranian santur to the world as a member of Yo-Yo Ma's Silk Road Ensemble. In order to be a good santur player, you obviously need a good santur. This is what brought me to a research center in the capital, Tehran, where I was able to observe how a santur is made from A to Z. Building a santur is a complicated task that can take 3 to 4 years. We've come to the Santur Research Center in Tehran to see the process. When we say that the construction of a santur may take 3 to 4 years, it's mostly because we need to wait until the wood has dried out completely. Aside from the box, the piece of wood that is placed on top plays an important part in the sound that the santur will make. And as always, precision is the name of the game. It is on top of this board that small adjustable bridges will be placed for the steel and brass strings to pass over.
Musical instrument retailers in Tehran have gathered in a neighborhood called Bahoristan. So as you take a stroll in this particular neighborhood, you can find plenty of musical instrument shops. What's special about them is that in most of them, there's a workshop where you can get your broken musical instrument repaired.
My stroll in Bahoristan took me to a big workshop where artisans were busy building and repairing santurs. Here's where I learned how they string a santur, a task that requires plenty of skill, and an important step that clearly affects the sound that the santur makes.
The 72 strings on top of the santur put a lot of pressure on the box. This makes this musical instrument quite vulnerable. But if anything happens, don't you worry, because skilled artisans are right around the corner to fix it.
The santur is not only becoming more and more popular among young Iranians, but along with Persian traditional music, it is gaining a foothold in today's music world. Gisumisha Ahmadi for Iran.
Trusted you a thousand times, but you always bring me back to the same place. My heart is moaning, but you can't hear. What do you care about me except my face? You think you know everything, you think you're enough, but sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. tried all I said. Is there anywhere left to save me? I need someone from heaven. I can heal my soul and not just my body. I need someone from heaven. I can make me free and not just happy. Today is over and I'm alone again. You show me a new movie, but then everything's the same. You give me small pills and push me to sleep, but you can't change my dreams, they're too deep. You think you know everything, you think you're enough, but sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all you said.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, lowering the gaze. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to A to Z here on Ibn Shreya with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously, the topic of lowering the gaze is, in a sense, it's always topical. This is not something that just applies to, let's say, immediately after the Islamic Revolution, during the Holy Defense, and indeed the years after that. This is just as relevant because obviously we see in our societies, whether we're in the, like, for example, in West Asia, or whether we're in the sort of, let's say, the rest of the world, in the Western countries in particular, this is relevant everywhere. And obviously this is why in Islam we're advised to lower the gaze. Now, lowering the gaze does not just apply to men, it also applies to women. I'll immediately say that. And lowering the gaze is obviously that it's a sort of attitude too. So it's not just looking away. So it's looking away. It's dressing in a particular way that is modest. So I'll just say that in a very sort of broad and general way. And it also refers to, you know, the way we talk, the way we behave. But let me just give, just as an example, from the life of the famous martyr, Sayyid Can Buzurgi from the Holy Defense. So he obviously practiced this idea of lowering the gaze. So at his wedding, in the family of his wife's house, for example, he was extremely modest, not just towards his wife, but also to all the other women in the house. So he was actually, it was said that he was shy both of his wife and of the other women. So he could barely look even at his wife and for sure at the other women. You know, this is something that maybe when some of us hear this nowadays, we think, oh, you know, we're not like that. That's not how people behave in our modern society. But I'm just going, I will talk about that a little bit because it's highly relevant, to be honest. Welcome back to Age Said here on I'm Being Shrey with my sister Zainab. And so I'm talking about lowering the gaze, and I'm talking about this sort of like this whole attitude that goes with it, because it is so important. So what can we say about lowering the gaze? So obviously it's something that is prescribed to us anyway. So what I'll say is that when we're surrounded by other people, whether it's, say, on the street, whether it's at uni, in the workplace, or if we have a big family gathering, maybe there's family members, and maybe there's even other friends or mixed genders, you know, it's fine. Our eyes, we almost cannot avoid seeing someone else, for sure. But what, where the problem then arises is if we sort of, yes, the word gaze. Gaze is to sort of really sort of take in more than just, you know, that first glance. So if when we're walking down the street and we sort of, you know, we just look at someone, you know, that's fine. Our eyes are always sort of gauging what's in the external world. Also just to sort of gauge what are there any dangers there. Do we need to be careful? Someone about to bump into us? Is there a cyclist to sort of getting too close to us? You know, whatever it is, we need to be observant anyway of our surroundings. But the territory that is tricky, and in fact I would say dangerous, is when we then sort of look the second time, or when we are actually gazing, so taking in. And I'll actually spell this out. So for example, if we're a man, if we're then looking at someone and we're sort of like gazing, taking in their body, so we can sort of say, oh, that woman has a nice body, and we're saying that to ourselves. And this is not in sense of telling off and sort of feeling, oh, we're all righteous. No, this is something we need to be aware of, every one of us. So are we doing this ourselves? Because we're not meant to. So this is where we really need to take stock ourselves. And, you know, obviously for sure, if we've become aware that we're doing this, you know, we need to ask forgiveness of Allah. And for sure, we should not be admitting these flaws to others. So we should not be saying to other people, especially, oh, look, I saw that woman, or I saw that guy, and yeah, he's a nice body. No, please not. Because, you know, we're exposing our faults to others. So this was obviously very honest, and I pray that you sort of appreciate that and take stock. And, you know, we really need to be a lot more careful. So that was it for today, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of Age Said here on IB English Radio. Me, Sister Zainab, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we provide an in-depth analysis of Israel's criminal behaviour and the effort it puts into influencing international policymakers and global public opinion. In today's show, we'll be examining who's behind the crisis at the BBC and how this relates to the corporation's coverage of Palestine and Israel. In our first report, Latif Rabochakra explains the role played by BBC board member Robbie Gibb in fomenting the upheaval in Britain's supposedly public service broadcaster.
An Israel lobby coup has taken place at the BBC with the resignation of Director General Tim Davey and new CEO Deborah Turness. But why have the Scottish First Minister, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, Ed Davey, and the union representing the largest number of BBC workers, BECTU, responding to this news by calling for BBC board member Robbie Gibb to resign? Gibb was the key mover behind this coup and is working for foreign interests. He was part of a consortium which saved the Israel lobby rag, the Jewish Chronicle, alongside former chairman of the Charity Commission, William Shawcross, John Woodcock, former head of the Labour Friends of Israel, and Jonathan Sakadotti, former head of the Zionist Federation. Gibb was a co-founder of the rancid channel GB News, which has worked against the BBC from its very inception. Gibb also has a paid job for the Kext CNC PR company, founded by Israeli Gershon Kext, a chairman of the Weizmann Institute in Israel. Kext CNC is a subsidiary of Publicis Group, and according to an internal message from Global Chief Executive Officer Arthur Sadon, many staff have already been called up to the Israeli military for the genocide in Gaza. All of Gibb's media outlets outside of the BBC have been calling for Davey to resign for supposed pro-Palestinian bias for several years. Israel's Deputy Foreign Minister, Sharon Haxel, even publicly called for Tim Davey's resignation in June 2025. The primary catalyst for the resignations was a leaked internal dossier from Michael Prescott, a supposedly independent advisor to the BBC's editorial guidelines committee. This memo, leaked to the right-wing Daily Telegraph, specifically accused the BBC Arabic service of anti-Israel and pro-Hamas biases and minimizing Israeli suffering in its Gaza coverage. This report was set into motion by Gibb, who appointed Prescott to carry it out. Simultaneous to that, Prescott is employed by PR firm Hanover Communications, which works directly for Larry Ellison's Oracle firm. Ellison is so close to Netanyahu that he offered him directorship of Oracle and also is the highest individual donor to the Israeli military in history. The Board of Deputies has long expressed concerns about the BBC's anti-Israel bias and called for deep cultural change after the resignations, seeing them as the start of a renewal process. This was an Israel lobby coup.
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. Our guest contributor today is the author, broadcaster, investigative journalist and former BBC insider, Tony Gosling. Welcome to the show. David, what do you know about this Robbie Gibb character and his role at the BBC?
Well, Robbie Gibb is the chief Zionist enforcer at the BBC. He's on the five-person editorial executive committee, which oversees all news and current affairs decisions. But he's not the only Zionist enforcer. There are many more, including on the executive committee. There are two or three others on the executive committee who are Zionists. And then further down the chain of command, there are many more in the newsroom, etc. But Gibb is a very interesting character. This is a guy who, of course, was involved with the Jewish Chronicle. The movement of the Jewish Chronicle from being an extremist Zionist organization to being an ultra-extremist Zionist organization. And of course, involved with, as the film showed there, with GB News. One of the interesting things about him, which is not widely known, is that he used to be a Western intelligence agent in the Soviet Union. Him and his brother, both of them. His brother, of course, has been in a kibbutz in Israel. It's said that they're not Jewish, but they were the CIA, it looks like, in the Soviet Union, involved with an organization which also had previously had MI6 involvement, but MI6 had pulled out of that. So this is a guy who's got intelligence links and, of course, now has been central to the takeover of the Jewish Chronicle, in fact, in charge of that takeover.
Wow. Well, Tony, I mean, the BBC has a history, doesn't it, of MI5 vetting its employees, but what's happened here differ from that?
Well, look, I think we have to understand what the BBC is and what broadcasting is, how it fits in to the rest of the world, because it's a relatively new thing to be able to broadcast live people speaking in the last 100 years, really. And so really what broadcasting is nowadays is a new thing, which is like the nervous system of humanity. So people can in real time supposedly see what's going on in other parts of the world. And whether it works or not is in the 1920s set the BBC up. We're aware that it could be used as a weapon of war. And that's why when they first started it, they came up with this slogan, Nations shall speak peace unto nation, which was underneath the badge, you know, the sort of public BBC. And of course, it has actually, in my lifetime, I think, been co-opted. But MI5, you're quite right, that's Britain's internal security service, were exposed in the 1980s by Mark Hollingsworth as vetting all the staff. I managed to get in by other routes. Basically, I knew some people who were news producers in London. And got in that way. But if you were to try and go through many of their official procedures, someone like me is unlikely to have managed to get into the BBC. MI5 most definitely involved in that. And I think we're now in the situation where that has become absolutely embedded in the corporation. You've got, not just the BBC, in other private broadcasters and newspapers in the capital. So, for example, Home Affairs correspondents will all be basically public relations people for MI5, attached to the Home, the Foreign Affairs stable of journalists, all pretty much saying the same kind of thing, associated with an MI6 point of view. In terms of finance, we've got the UK budget this week. You'll find all of the London correspondents looking at finance are being told what to think. The City of London and vetted by the City of London. So what we've got does not reflect society whatsoever anymore. It just reflects these sorts of elite institutions, as you mentioned, like MI5.
Yes, indeed. And in terms of the Zionist impact, though, Attorney, just say a word about that. I mean, obviously, talk about the MI5. I mean, and you've sort of set that out very, very clearly. But just say, does this differ from what's gone before? I mean, what's going on now?
Well, okay, so I started at the BBC in the late 1980s as a researcher and then went on to do reporting and journalism. I was there at a very interesting time because in 1911, Victor Rothschild, who was part of the Rothschild family, a very influential Labour peer, spoke to Marmaduke Hussey, who writes about it in his autobiography, who was the chairman at the BBC at the time, and he said to Marmaduke Hussey, "Can I see the director general?" So that was what was going on in the Thatcher era, because Alistair Milne was the director general of the BBC, who's basically like the chief editor there, and he was doing programmes which were critical of the Thatcher government. They had a panorama which was exposing the far right within the Conservative Party, I found it interesting that it was actually Victor Rothschild that broached the subject of getting rid of that director general. And then they replaced him with Michael Checkland, who was an accountant, and then with John Burt, who was the director general when I was working there.
Let me just move on to David, though, now, if I may, Tony, because we haven't got too much time. And I just wanted to get your thoughts, David, about, I mean, Latifah, as we heard, referred to this guy, Michael Prescott, in her report. I mean, just say a bit more about his role.
Well, this is yet another of the very many issues corruption within these processes. So Prescott had a dual role. He was working for the BBC and also for this PR firm, which, of course, has got all sorts of other clients, including, of course, working for the big tech firms, including Oracle, run mm-hmm. by Larry Ellison, the guy who's just taken over TikTok and CBS, yes. And is looking to take over other media platforms in the US, international media platforms. And of course, if they can, they want to take over as many media platforms as they can. And so that's what's behind this coup at the BBC, is an attempt to make sure that nobody in the mainstream media or in social media is able to be critical of the genocide.
Right, okay. Well, Tony, I mean, why do you think Israel and its lobby groups then are so fixated on the BBC?
Well, of course, it's because they want to create the impression that what the Israelis are doing is correct and right. Back in the 1990s, we had Zionists appearing in our newsroom. They come from outside broadcasting. It was questionable whether they were actually competent broadcasters, but they were pro-Israel. And there were lots of people raising eyebrows around our production office, Marylebone High Street, at Greater London Radio at the time, to see these people popping out of nowhere. So the process, I think, began in the late 1980s, early 1990s, of including these kind of basically Zionist agents. The idea really, I think, is to manipulate the public opinion. In fact, on a couple of occasions, I've had producers say to me, well, we haven't told the public what to think yet. And so there's an enormous amount of power in this whole broadcasting idea. But remember, they're speaking to less and less people. If you look at the Press Gazette's annual returns, you'll find that now it's a steady two-thirds, 65-70% of people in Britain don't trust what they see in the mass media anymore.
No, indeed.
So they've lost about two-thirds of the people.
I think that probably explains one of the reasons why the Zionist entity has lost the battle for public opinion, Tony. And I guess, you know, obviously, the BBC still likes to trade on its sort of reputation, as it were, as being a trustworthy source. And maybe that's another reason why the Zionist entity is so fixated on it. But, David, I mean, the Middle East, BBC's Middle East editor of their news website, Rafi Berg, I mean, just say a bit about him, will you, and his role in all this as well.
Well, I mean, Berg is clearly a very important element of this, but he's not the only one. I mean, there are Zionists spread throughout the corporation, and these are effectively Zionist gatekeepers. But Rafi Berg has become the most well-known because there's been stories about him, and, of course, there's this recent libel action which he is taking against Owen Jones, which I think is almost guaranteed to fail. But Berg is a fan of Netanyahu, who's written about the derring do of the Mossad, and he still remains in there as a kind of gatekeeper, along with many other Zionist gatekeepers inside the BBC, like there is in almost all of the other mainstream media outlets.
And Tony, just get your thoughts, really, on this libel action that David just mentioned, that Rafi Berg's taken against the Guardian columnist Owen Jones. What's your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, people like Rafi Berg are literally embedded now within, it's almost like in the brain cells of humanity. They're making sure that they're acting like, as David said, as gatekeepers. This is their job. Anyone who gets through, it stops anyone getting through. I remember hearing from Craig Murray, who I know is a friend of yours, how several times there are taxis taking him to a television centre to appear on a live television programme. And then the taxi driver has to turn around and take him back because somebody like Rafi Berg, although he's an internet guy actually, has intervened. Yeah. I mean, that seems to me to be the whole role nowadays of many of these specific individuals, and they don't reflect the humanity. I am very concerned, though, about this attack on the BBC at the moment, because we've got a privately owned all the time, and the BBC is really the only counter to it from the public sector. And what we've seen over the years is cross-media ownership and a handful of media proprietors. We've just got the Daily Telegraph being taken over by Daily Mail and General Trust at the moment. It's falling into fewer and fewer hands. And it's not just broadcasters or radio or newspapers. It's also magazines and books, all forms of media, in fact, including.
Tony, we're going to have to just move to our next report now, which looks at the fallout following the BBC's coverage of the Glastonbury Music Festival earlier this year.
Under international law, the right of people under colonial or foreign domination and foreign occupation to resist by all available means, including armed struggle, has been widely recognized and affirmed by numerous United Nations General Assembly resolutions. International law explicitly sanctions the targeting of occupying soldiers through armed operations. As occupied people, the Palestinians have the right to resist the Israeli occupation through armed resistance. However, punk rap duo Bob Villain has faced significant backlash and professional consequences, including canceled shows and revoked visas. Following pro-Palestinian comments made during their Glastonbury Festival set, in June 2025. During their performance, lead singer Bobby Villain led the crowd in chants of Free, Free Palestine and Death, Death to the IDF. This reflects the view of numerous UN resolutions that Palestinians have the right to protect themselves against occupying soldiers through armed force. This incident at Glastonbury was used as a weapon to force Davy out of the BBC. Performance was live-streamed by the BBC, which later expressed regret for not cutting the feed, and it triggered a police investigation. Following a rabid Israeli lobby campaign, the band was dropped from several festivals and tours, including Radar Festival in Manchester, a show in France, and a German tour. In October 2025, they postponed two headline UK gigs in Manchester and Leeds, citing political pressure from figures like Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson and Zionist groups who called for the gigs to be cancelled. The U.S. State Department also revoked the duo's visa, forcing the cancellation of their North American tour. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Christopher Landau stated that
foreigners who glorify violence and hatred are not welcome visitors to our country.
Their booking agent, United Talent Agency, UTA, also ended its relationship with the duo. Bob Villain's lead singer has stated he is not regretful of the chance and would do it again. In a statement, the band clarified that they're not calling for the death of Jews, Arabs, or any other race or group of people, but rather for the dismantling of a violent military machine, and that they are being targeted for speaking up. The rancid push to punish the group has been led by UK Lawyers for Israel and featured other less well-known lobby groups also. This call from the stage at Glastonbury featured heavily in the campaign against the BBC and was successfully used to force the resignation of Tim Davie, despite his capitulation after the fact. The UK Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer even joined in condemning the comments as appalling hate speech, adding to the pressure on venues. Despite the campaign, both Palestinian Resistance and Bob Villain still stand. The BBC, however, is a contested space.
Well, David, I mean, is what Bob Villain said actually controversial in your opinion?
Well, it's become a very, very popular worldwide slogan. You hear it in demonstrations all over the world.
Yeah.
And of course, it was something which was unusual in the British public sphere, not so much in America at the time, but in the British public sphere at the time. But it's become, they said when they did it, well, let's not have any more vanilla slogans, let's have something serious. And that, and he was making a serious point about the need to dismantle the so-called Israel Defense Forces. And of course, that's what most young people now believe is necessary as a matter of simple policy.
Yeah.
So not controversial in that sense, but of course very controversial in the parallel universe of Zionist sense-making. And that, of course, causes them to clutch their pearls and lose all their combobulation and of course, to try and stop him and the duo from playing anywhere, including, in Manchester, and a whole panoply of Zionist organisations got together for that.
That they use to silence opposition. But, Tony, when it comes to Israel, I mean, why does the BBC and the UK's corporate media seem to be so opposed to the application of international law?
Well, the fact is, I don't think they really are. It's just the people at the very top. If you look at the BBC's executive and its board, the foreign countries such as Israel take a great deal of interest in who is on those parts of the organisation and what their views are, and they're constantly trying to manoeuvre their people into those positions. But I think there will be many people in the BBC who will be cheering, privately maybe, without their bosses seeing, about Bobby Villain's comments in the summer. And isn't it interesting how that came out through the music and entertainment arm? Because the current affairs arm and the news arm of the BBC is so totally controlled. What we should be seeing is people like Glenn Deason, Jeffrey Sachs, Colonel Douglas McGregor, Scott Ritter on the news every evening. Very good experts. But they're being gatekept by people like Bobby Villain. And the other thing to mention is it's great to see live performances, live television, live radio, etc. is far, far cheaper to produce than pre-recorded. But they like to pre-record everything nowadays, even though it's much more expensive, because then they can control
it.
Things they don't want to see.
No, indeed. Let me just move on to you, David. I mean, what do you know about this United Talent Agency then that dropped Bob Villain after the Glastonbury Festival?
Well, this is one of a number of talent agencies based in the US, and in common with much of the entertainment industry, there's an iron grip of Zionist executives at the top of it. One of its first attempts to make sure that no one would mention Palestine was when it dropped Susan Sarandon in late 2023, and of course they've dropped Bob Villain now. This is part of the way in which Zionists are able to control entertainment firms, Hollywood movie companies, the music industry itself. Zionists at the top of all of these companies, and this is something which we, of course, have remarked on this show before, but it's something which people don't understand very well, that actually the Zionists are able to actually run these companies and are massively overrepresented at the top of them.
Yes, indeed, and when we point that out, and people point that out, they sort of accuse us of indulging in anti-Semitism. It's
of course they do.
Extraordinary state of affairs, isn't it? But Tony, in the past, I know that you made the assertion that before entering frontline politics, Tony Blair was NMI5 asset who was spying on the campaign for nuclear disarmament. I mean, do you still stand by that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, this all came out in conversations with the former MI5 officer, Annie Machon. She actually spoke to the editor of the Sunday Times, and they knew, Blair knew, that people from MI5 were out speaking in her and her former partner, David Shaler. And Blair was incredibly nervous because he knew that they may have seen his MI5 files. They keep these things very secret. And so he was really scared. So, yes, definitely, this is a massive interference in democratic politics, the secret services nowadays, who, of course, are a kind of form of permanent government. And they have got so arrogant that they just think that they can direct political affairs. And as you can see around the world, particularly in the West here, you see similar laws being passed in all sorts of countries and a mass increase in mass.
Yes, indeed.
So difficult for institutions to carry on. It's because all of the people at the top of those institutions, whether it be journalists, politicians or whatever, are all under surveillance constantly.
Yeah. Well, David, I mean, just going back to Bob Villain then, I mean, do you think he's likely to be charged?
No, I mean, we've seen a lot of these kinds of threats in the last year against anti-Zionists, and almost all of them have come to nothing. I mean, it was the alleged charges that were going to be thrown at NECAP, who were the ones whose live show at Glastonbury was removed, and Bob Villain replaced it. And, of course, that's what led to that whole story. So, no, Bob Villain is not going to be charged. NECAP have not been charged. Anti-Zionists are winning every week now cases in court. There was recently a case even in the US which has declared that anti-Zionist views are not anti-Semitic and should be protected. So we're winning this battle. And, of course, you know, they may have some victories now and again, but the tide is turning against their ability to impose whatever they want.
And, of course, you've been in the vanguard of that struggle in the UK, haven't you, to make anti-Zionist views, you know, a protected characteristic in employment law. But I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today, so I'd like to thank our guest, Tony Gosling, and make a date to join us again on Palestine Declassified next week, when I'll be back alongside David Miller with more revelations and information that you won't find in the corporate media. But until then, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Too many to count. Allah, Allah. Oh, my Lord, as much as I